evening, heroes.
And welcome to First Watch.
I'm Kat Cool.
And I'm James D'Amato. How are you doing this week, Kat?
Doing all right. How about you?
I am doing okay. It's been a long week, but there have been a bunch of small victories in it, so I'm always grateful for those.
What victories?
Let's see. This week, Fantasy Flight finally reached out to us, so...
Yeah, so we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I'm sure it's about to be a cease and desist.
Hopefully. Well, they said that they were excited to work with us, so I'm hoping for the opposite of that. But
they don't even know what we are yet.
I'm just hoping it's something that we can pass on to make the show cooler for people
even
to
better.
Listen to.
Yeah, no, that's what I hope. But we'll see. You know?
Yeah. Let's get right
that's
in.
A question for you. Mm-hmm. If we did get a cease and desist, obviously campaign would continue, but we wouldn't be able to use Star Wars anymore. So I think we'd be starting a different campaign. What do you think the second campaign system we do is going to be? This isn't binding. You know, we're probably not going to do either of these, but what's your thought?
I always pictured that, and this is, I guess, is a weird thing to picture going into after getting a cease and desist. Yeah, I always figured that we would do that silent protagonist buddy dungeoneering game.
Yeah, I really want to do that one.
But I
guess I figured that we'd do that one. I see it as shorter, so I thought we might do that as like a pay for side thing if we ever get the time.
Well, maybe. I mean, if we got hit with a cease and desist and we were like sort of floundering with no plans, like that's
that's a good idea.
That's a plan that we have that could fill time while we got to think of other stuff.
Which might be bad with a cease and desist, what with the nature of this silent protagonist scam.
Yeah, well, you know, I feel like they're probably not just throwing around C&Ds. We're just advertisement. And right. I think most corporations see it as copacetic.
I mean, they should. That's. I was just like the wildest thing. We're not allowed to do the Minot Cruise Adventures starting tomorrow. How do we handle it?
So, yeah, I guess that was our segment of scary campfire ghost story nightmare. So I think it's time for our knight and our witch to do a little bit of scrying and buying. So, Kat, let's scry in with you. Is there a big cool event that happened recently for you?
So there's not a singular big event, but I have something upcoming this weekend that's going to be ongoing that I'm kind of excited about. I recently joined Double Exposure's Dex Envoy Herald program.
Cool.
Yeah. That's if you guys don't know the Double Exposure people, please meet them. They're just the best. Vincent and Avi and their whole crew are just like top-notch people. They run cons like
Metatopia,
and then run the whatchamacallit hall. What's the name of that hall?
First Exposure Hall in Gen Con.
Right, which this year was huge, and I can't see that getting smaller anytime soon. Their whole vision is to, you know, increase gaming, get lesser known games out there. If you are a small press publisher, you probably know and love these people already.
And if you don't, you should know about them. So
yeah, absolutely. I think of Avi as like everybody's mom, and man, she earns the title. James and I probably wouldn't be doing the stuff we're doing on as big a level if it weren't for them and realizing how viable the stuff that we're doing is.
Yeah, absolutely. Our trip to Metatopia was magical. That's why we're going back this year. And I encourage anybody who listens to the show, who's an aspiring designer, whether you're a role-playing designer or a board game designer, or I guess, you know, really even a fiction writer, there are a lot of benefits to going to Double Exposure, meeting people who are not only like established figures in the industry, but other people like you who are starting up, because it's great to get help, advice, to inspire each other. It's a beautiful atmosphere that they've created at Double Exposure events. And the Envoy program is part of the mighty arm of Double Exposure. So, Kat, what's it like being an envoy, or what's it like being a herald, rather?
So, I haven't done any of the events yet, but so far it's pretty good. They recently started up these things called splashes, which are, I don't know if it started with somebody trying to break a record or what it is, but they're
actually, before we get to that, can you tell people what a herald is? Or is that part of that?
Fine. I can do it this way, too.
Inform the people before you explain to them.
No, I was going to as a part of it. I had my planned demo, but I see what you're doing.
Yeah.
Heralds are people who go around and demo games at shops, at conventions, with different playgroups. So if you have a playgroup in Chicago and you want to learn a new game, and you know the Envoy program covers that game, you could request that someone in your area, like me, comes around to your house on a Friday night and teaches you all a new game, bringing it with me. So they're people who know the game, can demo it, and go around doing that in different locations.
And you're doing this because Metatopia threatened to destroy your world. And so instead you just offered to show up to other people's houses and, you know, help them destroy those worlds, right?
No, I'm doing this because I wanted to get good at demoing games.
Oh, okay.
And I figured, why not? Yeah, I figured why not help people along the way instead of just doing it willy-nilly myself. So for me, that's the entire draw of this program. It's a structured way for me to learn and teach games and try to get good at a skill set that I haven't been actively practicing since college. But for people who aren't me and who want a more tangible reason to do it, if you pick a game, you learn it, you get certified in running it, and I had my first certification today. It was very nerve-wracking, but it was like totally no big, and I got certified, and it was great. If you put in a certain number of appearances per game, you get to keep the game.
Ooh.
So it's a good way to fill up your games collection without breaking the bank, because some of these are extremely expensive games.
Yeah, I really liked that aspect of it, because board gaming is kind of an expensive hobby. Every time you invest in something new to do, it can be like $50 to $150. Cthulhu Wars is $200, right? It's very expensive.
It's very expensive, but I doubt that that's a Dex Envoy game.
Well,
and if it were, it would be something that has like 20 appearances next to it, unless there's an event. So I'll get to the thing that I was going to talk about first in just a second. But I also wanted to say that aside from just getting up games, I was so like, it was weird to have an interview for it. You do interview to get in. But I was talking to Vinny, and he was like, why do you want to do this? And I'm like, I want to teach people. And he's like, okay, there's also this point system where you can level up throughout the thing and play a mini game and get rewards. I'm like, I don't care about rewards. I'm trying to help people. He's like, okay, but you should care about the awards because they're good.
It's like, I spent a lot of time working on them and I would like you to appreciate that.
So I still don't even know what they are, but if you wanted to know what they are and you got involved with the program, I have been assured that they're really nice. If you do decide to sign up now's a really good time because they just started this thing called Splashes. And I don't know if this is happening because somebody wanted to break a record somewhere or if they were just trying out a new marketing strategy. But between now and Christmas, they have set up more or less every weekend a different game for everybody to play. Typically, the way that the program works is you pick from their list of many, many games, mm-hmm. a game that you're interested in learning and teaching. But in this way, it's dictated to you. And you don't have to sign up for all of the splashes or anything. You can pick and choose which ones make sense for you. So I'm doing one this Saturday. I'm teaching Nefarious, which is a really cool mad scientist game by USAopoly and the guy who made Dominion. What's the name of that? At ValorCon, I'll be running another game that that map-making racing game that was huge at Gen Con. I forget what it's called.
Huh. I was not very aware of the board games at Gen Con, so I don't know either.
It was huge. It was doing really well. I'm excited to get to run it for people. I think it should be a really fun demo to run because it's a fun, fast game. Each of the splashes have like a reduced number of appearances to get the game. For example, Nefarious, I'm running this one splash, and that's all I need to run. I get to keep the game. And all of them are kind of structured like that. I'm probably going to keep teaching it to people and showing up places and doing appearances because, again, I'm in this to help. but if you're in it for those sweet, sweet games, now is definitely the time to join up with the program. It's a cool thing.
Ah, that's really cool. And I love the way they've gamified the process to encourage people to not just show off games that they know and like already.
Right. Yeah, that's the my goal with it is to I'm trying to learn like 6 new games every half year, 12 games a year. I'm trying to learn 12 games a year that I've just never played before. You know, that I'll probably learn more games, but I want to like go through the whole process, get certified, and teach people.
That's really, really cool. Well, that's exciting.
And yeah, so I feel like that's enough of me. What about you?
Oh, so scrying in on me. Let's see. I am right now planning Night of 10,000 Nights. Kat and I had a short conversation about this beforehand, and I'm sure I'm going to do a social media announcement, but here's as good a place as any. On Halloween this year, October 31st of 2015, I will be 10,000 days old. And normally I don't make a big deal out of birthdays or anything, but this is just such a weird, spooky coincidence that like I felt I had to do something. So I'm organizing.
We've
like,
been talking about Halloween creep 20K.
2K15.
For a while now.
That's Johnny's deal, and I am so proud of him. And keeping Halloween in our hearts and minds year round. And like, I'm definitely going to be roping him in on what to do with Night of 10,000 Nights. But it's going to be a party that I am going to invite a lot of one-shot performers to and fans. It'll be an open thing. And I just found out that we're going to do it at the Bug House Theater, right here in Chicago.
Ooh.
The
super spoopy
bugs. They're really creepy. But yeah, it's going to be fun and stupid and silly. And I guess the only other big thing that I've got going on right now, we recently recorded an episode of Campaign. And personally, it was one of the funniest episodes that I think we've ever done.
The two-parter.
There was a point where I was laughing so hard that I couldn't breathe. Like,
oh, man, which part?
It was just like when we were explaining one of the rules. I can't remember which rule. That was great. Oh, that's another thing that we can talk about later in this thing, actually, is how we stumbled onto a role-playing game that you can play while you're playing a role-playing game.
Okay, yeah.
But that's neither here nor there. During that game, part of the structure for one of those in-between episodes of Campaign is Kat wanted to do a fun horror thing, and we ended up playing some Dread for it, and we got a kill screen on Jenga, which is...
Yeah, they took it up to, what, 33, 34? What was the highest?
I think 34 stories is where we ended up, which... We ended at a place where there were no more legal moves. If anybody knows Jenga or knows Dread, the first two levels, the first two completed levels cannot be touched. So you have to go three levels down in order to make your pick. And so we got to a point where you could not pull any brick except for those upper levels. So the game was over. You just couldn't play Jenga anymore.
It's interesting. That's because of you guys doing that. I was looking at the way that world records on Jenga work. Because you have tied. I think you might have even exceeded the current world record holder because they're counting each block that you get on that final level.
Mm-hmm.
That's like one, two, or three blocks counts. Basically, Jenga is a game that has. It has a maximum number of moves, period.
Yeah.
You know, that if you guys had made some, just a few different choices earlier on in the game, that you would have had you could have had a potentially taller tower. As it was, you made the tallest possible tower you could. Since we have that recorded, you guys doing the entire thing and pictures of it, we might be able to submit it. But people video, you know, their playing through of the game. And now it's competitive to see who can get the, you know, since it's a beatable thing, it's a race to see who can get the max thing first, because that person will hold the record forever because there's no point in, you know?
Yeah, so theoretically it would be no middle pulls whatsoever. They'd have to just be side pulls, which,
yeah.
I mean, I discovered that our little group is really good at Jenga, but I don't know if we're that good at Jenga.
I will say this. Really cool game of Jenga. Really fun episode. Least effective game of Dread I've ever played.
Yeah, that sort of, it didn't work the way that it needed to. But I actually still think it was like a fun experience.
Oh, no, I think it was a worthwhile thing. I like how the episode turned out. It was just really bizarre that none of you quote unquote died, and I was really expecting at least one person to die.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be like a big two-parter where like one person would die and then like we would have to make up for that person and slowly the party would get whittled down until we had one person. We wanted to do
that's what I was expecting.
We wanted to do Cowboy Bebop's Toys in the Attic episode.
God,
because
I love that episode.
It's so good. And we didn't quite do it because after doing some of the best comedy work that we've ever done, we were too good at Jenga.
Yeah, they were too good at Jenga at like midnight on a Tuesday.
We were hopped up on comedy magic that we got skilled at Jenga because of it.
One of the weirdest nights of campaign that we've done to date.
It's going to be great. I can't wait to show that off to people. So with that, I think we can exit scrying section and let's talk about buy. Kat, you bought anything?
So the U.S. release of The Shepherd's Crown was this week, so I got that. Ooh. And I started reading it. I opened it up, I read the dedication, and started crying immediately. So this is going to be, it's going to be rough.
I have put off like buying, reading, and listening to that for so long. It's going to be so hard for me to do it.
It's a witch's book, so I have, well, I mean, I read everything as soon as it comes out all the time. If you've watched my progress on Star Wars books, it's like a day later I've read it. It's a witch book, so like I need to know right now because I know what's going to happen. You know, I know exactly what's going to happen. I don't want to start crying right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So for people who don't know, Shepherd's Crown is the last published Terry Pratchett book. It's the one that he did right before he passed, and it is in the Tiffany Aching cycle of stories. But the Tiffany Aching is also very tied into the witches, specifically Granny Weatherwax. So those particular stories are our favorites.
It's cool that we have this show where we just talk because like people get to see us, but they don't know much about us. So fun fact about Kat Murphy, that's more than any other fictional character.
Kat Cool.
I when I grow up. Oh, thank you. Wow.
I got to do it on you.
Something about Kat Cool, more than any other fictional character, the one that I want to be when I grow up is Esmeralda Weatherwax. What about you, James? Who's the number one that if you could just be someone when you grow up, take all of their skills, all of their learnings, who do you want to be?
You know, I don't know, actually. I don't know that I have a role model in that same way. I'm going to use the real douchey answer and say myself in 10 years. But no.
That's gross.
I actually, like, I have a lot of characters that I really like and admire. And I think the characters that I like and admire have ambitions that exceed my own. Like,
oh, interesting.
I really want to be a good comedian and I really want to do things to expand this hobby, but like I really like veterinary.
Yeah. Well, but that's the, so I don't mean that. Well, I mean, if we're real, I do want to be the best witch living alone
you
in a cottage
the
in a town. If I could be exactly Esme, I would be. But that's not really practical in my life. And moreover, there are a lot of areas of her life that she has sacrificed and let slip, and some that I don't even think she needs to have to become the person that she is. So it's not that I want to be her. That's ridiculous. I just want to have learned all the same lessons that she does and be able to present myself with as much confidence and be the number one witch, you know?
Yeah, I suppose Stephen Colbert, he's someone who effortlessly and fearlessly pushes boundaries on what it means to be a performer and a comedian, and I like that a lot.
I like how he's barely a fictional character, but he is a fictional character.
Funny. It's the public facing vision of.
No, exactly. It's funny to think of someone who has a real person analog and body as fictional, but he is.
And also like Spider-Man, but like just for morality's sake. Like, I like that he can keep to a conviction, but, you know, I also hope to be able to hold down a job.
Right.
You're doing that. Anything else going on? Because you said before the show that you were going to talk about Splatoon. So let's talk about Splatoon.
So this wasn't a buy for me. This was James's wedding present buy for John. A combination birthday wedding for John and myself. He got us the Splatoon edition of a Wii U. And I have been playing so much Splatoon. It's not okay. I started this past Saturday because there is the Splatfest that was Autobots and Decepticons. And Decepticons won All Hail Lord Starscream.
Oh, they won? I'm going to get treats when I log back in.
Ooh, treats. It really resonates with me. Here are the things that I like about Splatoon. I like that you don't know everybody is, you don't know who anybody is. There's a very limited interface. You get to be a boy or girl squid. And they all kind of look the same. You get to pick your skin color and they have a nice wide range. Other than that, you just customize what you're wearing, to get different benefits. But like everybody has the same design and your colors, like your hair and your clothes and stuff, the color of it changes depending on the color of ink that your team is using when you fight. Because, unlike a lot of shooters, competitive shooters, there are two goals. Well, there's one goal in Splatoon, which is to cover as much area of the field, of the level in ink that matches the color of your team. Now, as part of that is smashing other people so that they don't, so that they can't cover as much ground as you. But that's it. So it caters to so many different play styles. There are lots of people who are really effective snipers. And then, I'm someone who prefers the roller or the paintbrush because that lets me get through quickly to other areas and cover them in a lot of paint. I have so much fun covering the field in paint as effectively as possible.
Yeah. I love it so much because it takes away, I feel like, a lot of the pressure that I feel with a lot of first person shooters. I am not very good at video games, and first person shooters especially. I feel like I am either spending a lot of my time losing firefights or wandering around the level aimlessly, not being able to find people to get in fights with. Splatoon rewards that play style very well because like I can focus on doing the things that I think are important and significant. And like a lot of the time, most people are guests on Splatoon are used to other shooters and they're going off to fight people while I am making sure that everything is covered.
That's interesting. I found that I wouldn't say that it's even most. It really depends on the person's play style. I know what I'm working with based on like, you don't, unless you're playing with friends and you can, if you want to play with me, my Nintendo, whatchamacallit, what is that thing?
ID?
Yeah, but it's not that. My Miiverse login, and the way that you'd recognize me is Hedge_witch, and my character's name is all lowercase witch. And add me, let me know you're looking to play Splatoon. I will add you back, and we can be on a fierce team together. But when I'm playing in random normal rounds, the way that you don't know your team until you guys all spawn and you can see what other weapons people have. And based on the weapons that they have, whether they have paint cans, rollers, and then a number of different types of guns, I figure out what play style somebody good at that specific weapon is going to have and adjust my strategies to meet what they're doing. Which makes it so much fun. Like the idea of a shooter in which there are lots of different specializations instead of just making things conflict based is brilliant. And it's brilliant that it's ageless. There are kids, there are parents, there are so many different types of people playing Splatoon. And without a headset interface, all of the profanity and grossness that keeps me out of a lot of competitive games is just completely gone. There's no chance. The games are short. They're maybe 5 minutes. So there's like so low stakes, so much fun, and you can get really good at your chosen strategy. And then there's so much replayability too, because, I know what I'm doing right now, and I have a goal in mind of getting to like getting high enough level to get the ultimate version of the weapon with it, and max out all of my stuff there, but then I can pick up a different style of play and learn how to be good at that.
That's, yeah. Splatoon is just magical and great. It is. One of the reasons I like it, it's the same reason I like games like Rocket League, is its rounds are like 5 minutes. So I can play and not get too sucked into the game and have like a really easy cutting off point, but still feel like I played a game and like I had fun. It's not like something where with Fallout, where if I don't have 2 or 3 hours to sink into it, I feel like I barely played at all.
Ah, yeah, no, most of the time with me playing Splatoon, I will sit down, I will play 3 rounds just to like, to transition from either work mode to hanging out with my husband, or before bed to relax, like after doing a lot of tense work, something like that. And it's just 3 rounds, which takes around 15 minutes, and it's a blast and so super easy to walk away from. I love this game. I've never loved, like, I liked Team Fortress 2 a lot, and I played it a lot, but it didn't give me the same amount or type of enjoyment that this game does.
That's super cool. I'd like to talk about my buy now.
Talk about your buys.
Our good friend Sam K suggested to me a role-playing game that's not a tabletop RPG, that's a computer RPG called Darkest Dungeon. It is a side-scrolling, roguelike, it's not really roguelike. It is a dungeon-crawling RPG that is very inspired by the Cthulhu mythos. The basic story of it is that you have inherited this manor from your ancestors, and it's in this, like, bombed-out-looking little village, and it is full of unspeakable horrors. And to sort of restore your family's name and make this town less of a hellhole, you have to explore this dungeon, reclaim your family's wealth, and get rid of all the damn monsters everywhere. And the way you do this is by recruiting adventurers who roll in every day on a wagon. And you grab the adventurers that you want, and you send them off to the dungeon to explore. And it is a side-scrolling dungeon game. You have 4 adventurers that you monitor. They all have various classes and abilities that help you get through the dungeon. And it works very much, you know, like your Final Fantasy turn-based combat. However, in addition to hit points, they also have sanity. As your characters start losing it and becoming more unhinged, they start driving the rest of the party to become unhinged. Like, when you reach a certain halfway point with your sanity, your character will start saying morose things. They'll become like, they get different mental illnesses. They'll become like a nihilist, and they'll start saying things like, oh, well, none of this means anything anyway. And that bums out everybody else in the party.
But give me a different example.
You'll become like a misanthrope.
So it's all either ideologies or personality quirks that you don't get to pick.
Yeah, exactly. The trauma is like doled out by, like, you know, you're digging through bodies to get treasures, or like you're being attacked by horrible monsters. So based on the various stressors in the environment, and also based on random luck, you'll just acquire something that like brings the rest of the team down. If you like, there are certain circumstances where if you're really lucky, your little character will react to it by getting tougher and becoming like super brave in the face of danger, or having their faith restored at the last moment. Which can happen. It is very infrequent for that to happen. One of the coolest things that happened while I was in a dungeon, one of my jester characters, because you can bring jesters with you, it is very much in the OSR tradition of having adventurers and like just regular people accompany you on these dungeon crawls. One of my jester characters got a mental break, and it gave him a new ability, which was gallows humor.
Good.
So when they were around the campfire, I could activate his gallows humor ability, and he would make a really morose joke, and it would heal everybody's like sanity, because like he'd bring them back down to earth.
Right.
It's a really, really difficult game. It's great for resource management and grind, like really fun and interesting grind. And like, I'm still getting used to a lot of the different mechanics, but I am 32 weeks, quote unquote. That's like a round. That's a single session of dungeon crawling into it. And I have so far accomplished nothing. I've managed to level up, I think, 8 different adventurers to be level 1. So I have a long way to go, to leveling them up, but it's the sort of grind game that I like, especially because it's got turn-based combat. It's something that I can do while I'm editing and there's not anything major happening. So it's a fun little game. I believe it was $19 and it's not even completed yet. They still have, it's in development right now. They still have like a bunch of classes to add in, and there are a bunch of story elements that are not part of the game yet. And I already really like it. It's available on Steam and it's really cool.
Very cool.
So with that, let's move on to our next section. All right. And that brings us to one of our first knowledges, and that is knowledge engineering.
Knowledge engineering.
In our game, we recently, like I mentioned at the top of the show, we played a game with Curtis Weeb. We played 13th Age, which is Pelgrane's approach to D20 fantasy. And in that, Kat made a really cool choice with her character that, like, I think took everybody in the group by surprise.
And that's what surprised me. How shocked everyone seemed to be that I made this choice.
Well, you broke the rules, Kat.
do you want to say what it is, or should I?
I think you should. It was your idea.
Okay. So we were going around and saying what our mounts were going to be for an adventure that we had to ride out to for about half a day. So my character came out around the corner of her tavern with a bicycle. And
what? Hold on, Kat. The audience mind has not finished blowing yet.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's still shocking to me that this is shocking to you. Like, everyone had so many questions. I explained that, like, a new artisan had been making them. They were really expensive, and a lot of the nobility in the city had them. I was confused in character why there was so much shock, and I was just like, I saved up and bought it. What do you want from me? It's nice. I can have nice things if I want. But I get it now that what people were shocked about was that it was a bicycle instead of a horse, like they were expecting.
Well, yeah.
I see now. I see the rub.
Oh, your idea is so unprecedented. The only place I can think of with a medieval fantasy where they ended up having bicycles is a kid in King Arthur's court. That is the one example in fiction that I have off the top of my head right now.
I think the first time I've thought about having bicycles in fantasy settings for a long time. And I think the first character I was really like about to implement it on was one that I wanted to play in a 3.5 hack for Avatar The Last Airbender.
Wow. So you're a little bit ahead of the curve on that one, too, because that was before Avatar had announced Legend of Korra and that they were going to be advancing technology in it.
Yeah. So that's partially why I think I didn't end up like that didn't wind up as a final thing for that character's. Her whole deal is that she worked for the post office, and doing one of my favorite old character things of her entire character is built around delivering a single package and all of the adventures just get in the way. no sleet, no storm, no dead of night, etc. That she is, that she's going to deliver that package one day, no matter what happens. So original thought was a bicycle. And then I decided, but what about water? The bicycle doesn't work over water. So I think she has like an eel dog, that she rides around on and is best friends with. That's not the bicycle bit though. The bicycle bit is because, singular modes of transportation that can also serve as houses are really interesting to me. They always have been. And it struck me that a bicycle was really the ideal thing for an adventurer to get around.
Okay, hold on. Let's slow your roll even more here, because you ended one of those sentences with "that also serve as houses."
Okay, I think that you could attach a cart to a bike that has all of the stuff that adventurers need to cart around with them to serve as like a little, I don't know. People make like, what do you call those? Food trucks out of bikes on the back of them.
I guess that's true.
Yeah.
That makes sense. It's just, it's... That was like you adding a brand new element to this. But what I think this did for me was made me want to talk about elements of advanced technology that theoretically could have been around in a medieval, Renaissance, or, you know, whatever you look at your fantasy adventuring as, that sort of setting. One of those things that is like a prime example is the Klax system in Terry Pratchett. That is, for those who don't know, it's essentially using Morse code to communicate over long distance. And while it's
semaphore towers,
it's not like something like a telegraph, but it's way faster than any other type of communication would have been. And it could have revolutionized the way different countries operated and communicated in like a medieval time period. So applying things like that, and bicycles specifically, because bikes are something that when they were invented, 1800s, it was a big revolution in personal transport. Because it was something that didn't need to be maintained as much as a beast of burden needs to be maintained. And it was something that didn't take up a lot of space. It just represented a lot of freedom. And when you look at the art that came out that was advertising bicycles, it really reflected that. And that goes so well hand in hand with the sort of attitude of an adventuring party.
Absolutely. I just think that there's so much flexibility, freedom. You move faster than if you were just walking, but you don't even move that fast. You're going where you're going, wherever you want to be. You can magically mod out your bike to get through snow if that's your need. It just seems logical. It's always struck me as just a reasonable thing for an adventurer to aspire to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now I really, really desperately want to play a game where a party just has a big tandem bicycle that they all ride around on.
So,
just a four-person tandem, Kat.
Oh my god. Just like those booze cruise things.
Yeah!
Like a little shade. I can't, that's too good. But that takes away some of your mobility. That makes it a car instead of something that can go up on rocks.
Well, what about a four-person inline tandem?
Gross.
They'd look like dorkiest, greatest people who ever lived.
God, they're so cool.
Yeah, they're the coolest.
Okay, so that semaphore, which it came around in the 1700s, what are some other easy wins that could easily be incorporated into a world, a setting, where magic and advances in technology might have happened a little sooner than they would in standard medieval fare?
Well, I mean, one thing, obviously, that is touched on in a fairly major setting in Eberron, trains. Like, magic makes trains not only so much easier to build, but like a lot more practical as a means of transport too. Magic being the power for all sorts of anything that really came out in the Industrial Revolution, magic makes sense. Somebody pointed out to me that there's this collection of essays that says, in worlds with magic, the way that we are just putting magic in a medieval setting doesn't make sense, because people wouldn't live in a medieval setting if there was magic. Like,
exactly. It doesn't ever make any sense.
Like, if there's magic, you should not have a castle. A castle makes sense if you're trying to avoid a siege by an army, but it does not make sense if you are basically just giving a magician a big thing to target. It's much more likely that people would have dug down and lived in caves.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the first thought. I was like, then where would they live? Oh, they'd live underground.
And yeah, that's really, they just do their fortresses underground. They probably still live on the surface.
Oh, yeah, they probably still live on the surface, but all of their, that's, huh. And, like, anti-scrying is a much larger part. It depends on how magic's distributed. Because if it's such a layman's thing, then something that Tumblr gave me that I adore is the idea of modern mages maintaining Starbucks and putting good luck and charms and stuff in people's coffee at the beginning of the day, because they're such easy shots of potions, you know, that there's a, we'd see magic in the mundane so much more frequently depending on how common spellcasters were.
Yeah, that's true. I can actually picture like a Starbucks type situation, yeah, where people are just
totally
like,
totally makes sense,
distilling potions and whatnot. That's really cool. One of the things that makes it like I feel like communication magic is something that would come up a lot more. Like I mentioned it as a joke in our game of Witch, but using Ouija boards to communicate, spells like message and whatnot in D&D, if that was a thing that magic presented, I really sincerely believe that people would have spent a lot of time and research advancing that type of magic to the point where you are communicating a lot more quickly and conveniently. Like, if you look at a show like Star Trek, they predicted the cell phone because it is such an obvious and convenient thing to have a communicator that you can talk to different people on.
That's actually, I think communication is a really good way to judge what the rest of your technology is, and magically integrated technology is going to be, and what time period you should set your setting in. Because for me, cell phones in a medieval setting will never make sense. Because, like, if people are basically working off of message amplification, then there are going to be too many crossed lines. That doesn't work. But a variation of a semaphore that's reliant on people being able to speak loudly to each other from a distance, like, if you get up high enough, then you can, it's still kind of telegraph style, reliant on one thing sending out and receiving messages.
You're basically pitching tin cans with string right now.
Yeah, but it's tin cans with string, but 300 years earlier than it hit in round world.
Well, actually, that tin cans brings up something interesting. Canning. The idea of canning and being able to easily mass produce something that is sealed to the air. A lot of medieval settings are dependent on food being difficult to get. Like, people are poor and living in squalor because it is hard to distribute fresh, healthy food. Canning changes the game. It's a huge game changer. And it would be something that would be immediately relevant to parties, because carrying around preserved goods obviously enables you to adventure more. And if you apply this idea to magic, like having different spells and different magical ingredients break down or vary on their effectiveness based on freshness, that changes a lot too.
That is something that, like, okay, time to talk a bit about magic theory. That's the James pause. Part of James and I are thinking about things that we can get the audience involved in terms of our topics of discussion, because I think that so many, if we just leave it open, I think that we're not going to get really specific or particularly interesting questions, stuff that we might have answered on other channels, because if you give people too broad of a range of stuff, it's like, meh. I like this knowledge format because it allows us to really drill down into specifics. So I think we should let people know about some of the things we persistently think about so that they can ask us questions of about a specific thing that we put a lot of thought into. I think a lot about monsters. I think a lot about fae and folklore. I think a lot about different magic systems and the way we talk about magic in fiction. So this canning idea brings up something that I have not yet encountered that I'm in love with. Most of the time when you have spells that exist in a land over time, they have a magical half-life. So the spell becomes less powerful as time goes on. There's the idea of, you know, that's twice the length of the wizard's life is the end of the most powerful any spell that a wizard had cast. Something like that. But with this, we have the idea of magical fermentation. Spells getting changing and getting more powerful over time. Magical, I've thought of this idea of a windery where people can winds and grow them like a winery. Applying that in a magical sense, fascinating.
Magical distilleries is fascinating.
Yeah, just the idea of like opening up a bottle of a 200-year-old charm spell. That's
Oh my god, that's
freaking cool.
That's really cool. Well, I love so much because it also ties into alchemy and ties into like us finding magic in just plants and living things too. Like each, like there are certain things that age well and certain things that don't. And this ties into my cocktail nerdery. It's just, there's so many different ideas involved in like mixing and waiting and letting it sit. Oh, that's so cool.
And then if you take into account all of the different things that different cultures tend to ferment and pickle, like my parents, when they lived in Japan, lived above a pickling shop, which is something that's it looks the same now today as it did when they lived there, as it did 50 years prior to that. It's this fascinating wooden shop with like tons of barrels full of, oh God, any number of things. Japan pickles everything. And, like, if you take that versus cultures that primarily make alcohol versus places that put crows in a seal's belly and then sew that up for a long period of time, lots of cool things you can do.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, I think we can revisit magical fermentation and canning and preserving some point later, but I feel like that's a good discussion for right now. So with that, I believe it's time for our random encounter.
Ooh. James gets his number one wish, everybody.
Yeah.
Today we're talking about kobolds.
Randomly rolled. So let's talk about kobolds and let's explain kobolds a little bit. Let's start with Dungeons and Dragons kobolds, because kobolds are a monster that Dungeons and Dragons sort of co-opted and added flavor to.
Changed a lot, actually. So
folklorically, kobolds are not little lizard people, but let's start by talking about little lizard people.
Yep.
So the kobolds that you see in most fantasy role-playing are little dragon spawn things. They usually range in 2 to 3 feet tall, and they are intelligent creatures, but they're also intelligent creatures that are meant to be killed by parties from first to like third level, and fourth level is like pushing it. So it what's interesting to me about kobolds and what I like, I can't say what I like the most about them because I like so much
you
about
like
them.
A lot, yeah.
But they
in
are.
In fact, that's the. I think these days I think of you. When I think about people as fantasy characters, I think of them in two categories: them as a medium sized creature and them as a small sized creature. because I think that they're two. You know that they're. There are so many small races in D&D, and it's not exactly that there's overlap, but stuff when it's sized down purposefully oftentimes in systems gets cuter and simpler and quirkier. Mm-hmm. So James at medium size is a spell scale, and at small sized is a kobold.
I take that as a compliment. So yeah, as I was saying, because they're meant to be thrown at low-level parties, they're kind of dumb. Their societies are weird and don't make a lot of sense. And as a race, they are almost universally servile. They're always operating under a more powerful being, whether that's a lich or a dragon. They're not really operating on their own initiative. So they're interesting monsters, but meant to be used as mob monsters and monsters that aren't very important, and they are the extension of a larger force.
Right.
I'm just bringing up Wikipedia here because Briggs does not have an entry on kobolds. The kobold is a sprite stemming from Germanic mythology. Although usually invisible, a kobold can materialize in the form of an animal, fire, a human being, a candle. Most common depictions of kobolds have them as human-like figures the size of small children. Kobolds who live in human homes wear the clothing of peasants. Those who live in mines are hunched and ugly. Kobolds who live on ships smoke pipes and wear sailor's clothing. So one thing that we're learning about kobolds digging into their original mythic origins is that they could fill a lot of different roles.
Well, that's also, yeah, that's, they're often brought up as a Germanic counterpart to a lot of like goblins and, gnomes and underground dwelling sprites that were common in England and Ireland and other folkloric traditions, which is, I think, how they became the enemies of gnomes, but I'm looking into this right now because they've always in D&D been the enemies of gnomes. They haven't always been draconic, but they have always been like the dark side of gnomes. Like Dwergar are the dark side of dwarves.
And elephants are the enemies of dragons.
Well, okay, but that doesn't happen in D&D. It should, but it doesn't.
Bro, if we got elephants, they would fuck up a dragon.
Actually, let me check that and see if there's a cool thing in there.
Okay.
Which has nothing to do with how they wound up in D&D at all. Gary Gygax took the name kobold from Germanic kobolds. Instead, they're these dog-faced, very gnome-like creatures in the original D&D that are meant to just be evil gnomes. That was really the point of them. And it wasn't until 3.0 that they started looking like dragons.
Oh, really? In second edition, they were also dog-faced?
Yeah, that's they had like dragon mountain ones, but I don't think that those had draconic attributes either. They looked like more pug-faced gnome.
Yeah, in older editions, they look like pugs.
Well, pug-faced humanoids.
Yeah, yeah. So I've got the second edition Monstrous Compendium with me right now, and I feel like the kobolds in this look kind of boring because...
Yeah, which is probably why they upgraded them to look like dragons, because they really were only serving the space of gnomes that you should be killing.
Well,
that's true.
And Japan, in particular, really attached itself to that first edition dog-headed idea of kobolds. So if you look at games like Final Fantasy and, oh goodness, what was that MMO that had like the really cute sprites that was from Korea?
Oh, I don't know. When I think of them, of the like dog-faced one, I remember that one game that had Pun Pun in it, and Pun Pun looked like a Japanese kobold. So it looked like a cute dog humanoid.
Huh. Pun Pun was 3.5.
No, I know. But there was... Do you don't remember this? There was like a Les Miserables fighting game that also had Pun Pun as one of the characters you could unlock. Did you not play this game?
No,
all the time
I wanted to, but I never got to play that one.
Well, it was all of the Les Mis characters and also Pun Pun, Destroyer of Worlds.
Weird. Great. Yeah. Yeah. So kobolds, I guess, like taking in all of this from mythology and from older editions of D&D and from role-playing games from other countries, kobolds were catch-all and they filled a lot of different roles.
Do you see them filling a lot of different roles? I mean, in mythology, it's a type of goblin that has a specific function and as weird a backstory as a Clowercon or anything else. But in D&D, to me, it seemed that they always were just evil goblins, or like that evil-like goblins, things that you're at low level supposed to nebulously kill and whose motives are live and be evil. And then they started getting flavor in 3.5 when we made them draconic instead of just standard gnome fare. And since then, Like they still feel more or less not built out. It feels like we put the majority of stuff on them. That they're little draconic humanoids that don't, for the most part, have wings.
Well, what I meant by fill a lot of different roles is the Germanic kobolds had like three different varieties, not all that different than looking in your basic player information guide, learning there are mountain versions of this and there are forest versions of this. You know, like if they were on sailing ships, they looked like sailors. And if they were in your house, they were just like a peasant. And if they were in a mine.
Right. Yeah, I think the thing that we could most easily equate the German, the folklore version of a kobold with is a brownie. It's a house sprite and it has a lot of different forms.
But yeah, I do think you're right in that people didn't quite know what to do with kobolds to make them distinct, really, until they made them draconic. And even then, like, they're just a smaller version of Lizard Man.
Yeah, they're really interesting. That's what's the name of the dragon race book that you like so much?
Races of the Dragon.
Oh, it's Races of the Dragon. That had a cool write-up for them because it talked about how they think they worship individual dragons that they made dragonborn, right? They put people in eggs and then worshiped them and followed them around and stuff. And there was some hierarchy that had to do where if you were a kobold born with wings, you were better than everybody else and given elevated status. They had them dwell in swamps and made them witches and shamans a lot of the time.
Yeah, but like linking them to dragons is where I think they really began to shine, in that they looked at a need that they had and they're like, okay, we need servile races. We need people that follow the big bad and do their bidding so that we can fill out these dungeons and give our big bad evil guys minions to send out and do things. And like, you can do that with skeleton armies, but at least in 3.5, you weren't able to crit on skeletons. So an undead fight was a very specific type of fight. So the kobold was a way to bridge that gap and be like, oh, well, we have these creatures that worship dragons and follow dragons, but they are just people that your third level party can handle no problem.
Right.
So let's do our first thing in the random encounter and talk about how, as players, we are going to defeat kobolds.
Do we not want to talk about their rivalry with gnomes?
Oh, yeah, sure. Let's bring up the rivalry with gnomes first.
Okay. Something that I've always liked about kobolds, that's something that I want to talk about, is, James, why do you like kobolds so much? We'll get there in a second. Part of why I like kobolds is that they're written with a very explicit hatred and rivalry of gnomes. And the reasoning behind this is that Garl Glittergold, who is the gnome god, once played a prank on a really, really high-ranking kobold. And since then, the two races have had an instinctual mechanic hatred of each other.
Which is wonderful.
Yeah, it's so good.
The reason that I like kobolds is actually related to that. It's in Eberron, gnomes very specifically have put together a public relations smear campaign to keep kobolds as an evil race that is outside of society. And I did not like that. I was like, well, screw gnomes.
Right.
So when I put together my first role-playing game, the one thing that I knew, the seed that sprouted into that world, was that gnomes are going to be the most hated race and kobolds are going to be the most beloved race. And actually, this is going to play into how I make the monster better. So we'll cut that short for right now, because I have a lot of feelings about kobolds, but that's where it stems from.
I suspect that you like kobolds because you get to talk like this.
Yes, the kobold voice is a superior voice for role-playing. It allows you to go into greater emotional depths.
I think that's true. There was a player that we used to play with whose like characters were fine and fun. But when he got to play this one kobold, it was the most enjoyable I ever, like, it was the best that it's ever been playing with him.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, that actually plays into the other reason that I like kobolds, and is that in 3.5, they were the worst mechanically. Like,
yes.
They had two bad stats and nothing to make up for it. I think it was like -2 to strength and -4 to charisma or something like that.
Right.
They got a -4 and a -2 and I think dexterity. They got +2 in dexterity. So it was just bad. Being a kobold was a bad idea.
But if you made a kobold, you could make a good kobold. And when you did, they were the most interesting characters. And the metagamers in us love that challenge and
yeah.
The thrill of playing something that's supposed to be really bad.
Kobold Shugenja, man. Anyway.
Okay.
So it's time to defeat this monster.
Okay. So are we dealing with... So we're on watch. A kobold has wandered into camp. What sort of kobold is it? Like, is it one kobold?
Oh, it's never one kobold. When you are fighting kobolds, they are always working as part of a unit, because if it's a single kobold, it will either get one hit on you and then die next round, or you will take it an initiative and just kill it right away.
So you and I are sitting here at first watch. We're looking at the fire, looking at other things, eating some preserves. We hear a grumble, rumble, rumble, rumble. Look behind us, and then the forest floor kind of collapses a bit, and a tunnel opens up to a group of 5 confused-looking miners, little kobolds holding picks.
Oh, no. In this situation, I just diplomatically convince them not to attack us.
Well, I think that's a good point. So one of us who speaks goblin will be like, "Hey, guys, what's up?"
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if that is the random encounter situation that you're picturing, one of the cool things about kobolds is they are intelligent. They are also notoriously cowardly.
They often speak either goblin, orcish, or draconic. So if you speak one of those languages, try appealing to reason of, yeah, just brace your mind better and we have no problem with you. Please go away.
And that's a thing that I always feel is so unfortunate about a lot of different role-playing circumstances, especially with goblins and kobolds. It would be fun to talk to them. And most of the time, the dungeon master doesn't allow it, or the players don't think of it. These are intelligent races, and you can play with that intelligence. And I encourage people to do that.
But these kobolds, the lead miner adjusts the strap of his, I don't know, what's he wearing, of his skull necklace and says, "You are on grounds belonging to Colonel Mac. Since you have trespassed here, he dictates that you must die." And all of the little kobolds rally and prepare to kill all of you because their god, Colonel Mac, the god of mining and war, has some pretty outrageous things he believes. So since we've trespassed, we must die.
Yeah, I can't. You've made them too cute. I'm not going to murder these things.
No, you have to fight me. Fight me.
So I place a hand on his head so that he can't reach me with his tiny little arms.
Oh, no, my arms are spinning.
Yeah. I think in that circumstance, like, I still feel like there's a way to talk your way out of it, either through charm person, because I get, does charm person just limited to humanoids?
Aren't these humanoids?
Yeah, I can't remember if they count as humanoids because they're so small.
I have an MM here.
I guess if gnomes count as humanoids, these would count as humanoids.
I believe they count as, well, no, gnomes and halflings count as humanoids. People don't get discounted as human just because they're small. It has to do with an intelligence score and how many legs you have.
That's how it works. It's got to do with how many legs you have.
You heard it here first. Yeah, small reptilian humanoids.
Okay, so yeah, charm person would work in this situation. Diplomacy checks, bluff checks could work in this situation. I think if a kobold is ambushing you in a random encounter, it is not going to start with a dialogue. The way I picture a kobold ambush going down is that you have holed up in a room in a dungeon, and either the kobolds have a way to get into that room that you don't know about, or they break down the door, or they are setting up a trap for you outside when you wake up. Because kobolds are working as a unit, and if they want to kill you, they know that they're probably not going to get you in a one-on-one fight, which is why they're going to be using ambush tactics throughout your encounters with them. So the best way to fight kobolds is to prepare for kobolds and make sure that you have alarms around the camp so you are awake if something crosses that barrier, making sure that you are prepared to check for traps the next day, and that you are sure in how the dungeon is mapped out, because they will turn those advantages against you. They're crafty.
Yeah, no, they're really funny societally. Their god hates all things that are not kobolds. So they get up to some pretty terrible atrocities in the name of their god. So if you can't appeal to them, it's really just about being ready to smash through them and know that one might be sneaking up behind you who either has a breath weapon or can cast spells.
Yeah.
Those guys are revered, and that is the way that they would logically attack with them.
Yeah, what you want to do is draw them out into the open so that you can use area of effect abilities against them. Kobolds don't have many hit points to their name, so when you hit a large swath of them with an area of effect spell, it's going to be really effective. If you're taking them on one-on-one, you know, the ratio of kobolds to you is probably at least going to be 4-1. So you're going to want to make sure that you're not just hacking away at them, that you're taking out more than one at a time. Otherwise, they're going to really lower your hit points and ambush you in a place where you're at a real disadvantage.
If you are going into a occupied by kobolds, I think the most deadly thing about them and the thing to be wary of is that they are trapsmiths. So you're going to want to be on high alert for traps made by kobolds.
All right.
That's it.
Yeah, I think the tactical advice is pretty straightforward, mainly because they are just a mob opponent.
How do you make them better?
Well, Kat, I have so many ways. Let's talk to you first.
Oh, how would I make a bit of first? That's not fair. Okay, no, I got one. The kobold god is fine, but he's kind of boring to me. A lot of what it feels like people do with kobolds, or like the way kobolds are set up, is that, their god aside, it feels like the main thing they like to do is mine. And the main reason people would have problems with that is that that depletes resources that other people want. And I hate that story. So instead, the way that I would make kobolds evil and the things that I would do to get them out of their lairs and interacting with the world, which would also give them more interesting motivations, is I would make them the servants of specific dragons who play Zorventhal games.
Mm. And for those who don't know, Zorventhal is?
Zorventhal is a game with really nebulous rules played by old dragons. Their goal is to be the single most powerful dragon and win in some insane gambit. And they employ, and like the rules are all like, people can't know you're playing the game. You can't let your followers know that they are a part of the game. You can't say anything about the game in front of another dragon. It's very much like Vampire the Masquerade. Dragons in D&D are playing Vampire the Masquerade.
Oh, I love that. Oh, it's so dumb.
That's what it is.
That's great.
I would have kobolds be minions of these specific dragons, and either the kobolds know about the game and like they're the one known thing, or they're just going on different missions. That means that the ways you'd interact with them or find them out in the world would be hugely different to just encountering lairs, because Zorventhal games are all like, hey, I want someone who's working for me to be running this country for 10 years. Or I want all of the ley lines in this area to have rubies under X crossroads. You know, that they're weird point scoring systems. So if you run into little extremist kobolds, and they could have some way neater motivations than just, my angry mining and war god thinks everything but kobolds should die.
Yeah.
And that would also give you a good reason to have a diplomatic conversation with them. Because if you're running into them just trying to bury a ruby under some crossroads, maybe that doesn't have to end in bloodshed. And it lets you into a potentially really interesting adventure hook.
I think that's good. And that's capitalizing on what kobolds are good at normally, in being the representative of a larger, more dangerous force. So my approach to kobolds is different. And I started developing this actually when Kat and I played a fourth edition game with our friend Sam and Derek and
Adam and Kevin.
With our friend Sam, Derek, Adam, and Kevin. Derek and Adam have also been on One Shot, and as well as Sam. God, I don't even remember the setting that we were doing, but I wanted to play a kobold. I had no interest in fourth edition, but I liked kobolds, so I wanted to play like this dumb thing that wasn't going to be mechanically powerful, also because I was trying to suppress my power gaming instincts. So I picked kobold, and I took a look at the setting, and I tried to look for ways for kobolds to be involved with that. And what I found is that I think kobolds are most interesting when you try to integrate them with society, because the way a lot of different role-playing games treat them is essentially like vermin. And the idea of having sentient vermin is fascinating to me. So yeah. I really wanted to embrace how kobolds are weird and gross and live in crawl spaces. So what I do with my own setting at home is, and the way that I get kobolds to be the most beloved race of all time is, most people like kobolds because kobolds are familiar, because most homes had kobolds living in their crawl spaces.
Well, why would people like them? What did they not like them, but for the same reason?
Because they are renting out that crawl space. So the kobold is a tenant that pays rent to you, and essentially they're like everyone's next door neighbor.
Cool. I like it. I like it. I wanted to say that if you're in a Zorvanthal game, the thing that could lead potentially interesting things with kobolds is giving them an auxiliary power, because then their scales would be the color of the dragon that they serve, and they'd have powers based around that.
Mm-hmm.
Because as it stands, the reason we're talking about ways to give them different social dynamics is because right now they're just two hands that can hold weapons and swing. They don't have a lot going on, going for them. And that doesn't feel fair to the monster.
Yeah. And it's like, there's so much you can investigate about that. The thing that annoys me about things like gnomes, gnomes and halflings specifically, well, they are just small people. And they still operate like small people. When you have a small lizard, that gives you the excuse to have these things grow up with a completely different mentality and society. And you can play with things being alien a little bit. Like in Just Fink and Eric Colossal's game on our show, we had a lizard man professor. He got stood up for a date, so he comforted himself by eating a bowl of mice. And, like, it's so weird and gross, but, like...
No, that's good. Well, but that's the... There are things that already exist in kobold's descriptions that you could use to that effect. For example, in their lairs, they're supposed to have one egg per 10 adults, which is just, like, a cool detail, but why? What does that mean about a family structure? Whose egg is that? And also, if it's such infrequently that people have eggs, how are they so prevalent? Lots of questions and cool things to think about with kobolds.
Well, one egg for 10 adults at all times, though. Like, if you think of a kobold warren, like, they are at least a tenth of their population is reproducing all the time. And what's
I see what you say.
Gestation
yep, that
period.
Makes sense.
The other thing that I like to play with kobolds that is a really sad and dark and humorous thing about them is these are dragon-blooded creatures that have a short life expectancy. Now, if you look at dragon blood in D&D, it is always supposed to extend your lifespan. So the reason they have a short life expectancy is because they're getting killed, not because biologically they would die quickly. They should live, theoretically, for hundreds of years.
Oh, no.
And that plays... That plays into the great dragon tyrant. So I was trying to think of an excuse for why kobolds live like this, why they are living in crawl spaces and being weird vermin. And it's because they have a very deeply ingrained and instinctual culture. A lot of what kobolds are doing has to be on instinct because lizards operate more on instinct than, say, mammals. Mammals have a lot of teaching and learning going on. Lizards are sort of born knowing things. So kobolds have this weird cultish religion in my setting called the Great Dragon Tyrant, where any given dragon is in charge of these kobolds, and like their lives are miserable and short and nasty, and it's because the tyrant says so, and like that's what they believe in, and they believe in it cheerfully and happily.
Poor kobolds. We should talk about gnomes sometimes, because I love gnomes.
Yeah, well,
if I were a small race, I would be a gnome.
Yeah, but we're not talking about gnomes right now. We're gonna pull back on the gnomes, and we're gonna wait until they have their turn. Okay?
Fine. Possibly next time.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, I think integrating them into society so that you can have a harmless touch of alienness. I think a lot of times when we incorporate something alien into role playing, it's because something is mysterious and powerful. And I like kobolds because they're baffling and powerless.
Yeah.
So the one thing that we forgot to do is rate them. Kat, scale of 1 to 10, you got to rate kobolds.
Got to rate kobolds? Oh, no, but, like, in what sense? Because, like, here's the thing. As a combatant, they're, like, 2. But in my heart, they're at least a 10.
Well, for me, Kat, across the board, kobolds, 10 out of 10. All right, and that is the end of our show.
Thanks for listening to it.
Thanks for listening.
Time.
And thanks for backing us on Patreon.
We got to go wake up the fighter.
Yep.